This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Thank you for coming back from week to week to listen to this podcast. We really appreciate you listening. I know there are a lot of other podcasts to listen to, and oftentimes I'm asked, what are some of my other favorite podcasts I like to hear? Well, let me give you just a couple of suggestions. One is Creativity in Captivity by Pat Hazel. Pat's a good friend of mine who you may have heard on this podcast in the past, and this past week he had released an episode that featured another one of my favorite people, and that's Ray Anderson, who is a star of Esther's Follies in Austin, Texas. If you haven't had a chance to listen to that episode, I suggest you do that and also subscribe to Creativity in Captivity. Another one that I really enjoy is John Gaspard's podcast, which is called Behind the Page. What he does with Jim Cunningham is to go back to the books that he has written, the Eli Marks mysteries, and then has interviews with many people who would relate to the chapters that are going to be read each week on the podcast. So he has the first book of The Ambitious Card been completed, and he's now into the second season, which is The Bullet Catch. And if you haven't purchased the book and you'd like to hear it read, Jim Cunningham is the one who will read this chapter by chapter. Each week they release a different chapter. And anyhow, it's marvelous, and I recommend that. It's called Behind the Page. He has some fabulous guests and some really great conversations, many of whom you may have heard here on this podcast and others you haven't that I know you'll enjoy. Speaking of John Gaspard, I want to thank him for giving us the gift of the 3 ebooks, which are going to be available in a contest. Yes, a contest. That's going to be an opportunity for you guys to enter a contest for a chance to win one of 3 ebooks that can be sent digitally wherever you live in the world. So I encourage each and every one of you throughout the world to go to our website at themagicwordpodcast.com for this week's episode, number 667. And there you can find a form you can complete and enter the contest, and then there will be a random drawing from the spreadsheet that I would receive, then you'll be notified if you're a winner, and then John will send you a link to where you can download and read the ebook of his collection of writings called The Self-Working Trick. Well, this week we're going to go back to Columbus, Ohio, when I had attended the Columbus Magi Fest, and one of the presenters there this year was Jason England. And I've been wanting to talk with Jason for a long time where we could actually just sit down and quiet and not have any interruptions and just kind of let the conversation flow. And that's exactly what happened. And it was just phenomenal. We had a lot of really great things we talked about. Jason is someone who is well known for his expertise and his collection of gambling devices, as well as his consulting work a little bit here and there with casinos, as well as knowing and collecting a few things that used to belong to Titanic Thompson. And of course, as far as S.W. Erdenace, who he really was, and he has a pretty good collection of books as well, from the original on to many of the copies of Expert at the Card Table. Anyhow, fascinating conversation we have. This one is particularly chock full of stories, and I know you'll love stories, and he's got a lot to share on so many different subjects, and you're going to love this. I know I did. So please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Jason England, here on The Magic Word. So here we are at the Magi Fest in Columbus, Ohio, 2022, and one of the speakers and part of the talent is someone I've been wanting to talk to for a long time, and that's Jason England, who is someone who is well-known, and I want to talk to him a lot about Erdenace, because I know he is an Erdenace expert. He and between him and Dick Hatch, I don't think anything else needs to be said. We'll talk about that, as well as, of course, his affinity with gambling and collecting of gambling. Lives in Las Vegas, which makes it perfect. Please welcome my guest, Jason England. Hey there, Jason.
Hey, Scott, how are you?
Fine, thank you. How about that for an introduction?
That's just fine. You summed it all up.
Well, not all of your life. There are a lot of other things that you do that you have of interest. When did you move to Vegas, by the way? How long have you been out there?
It will be 15 years in May, May of 22. So we're coming up on our 15th year living in Las Vegas. Of course, I visited many times before I moved there. But yeah, we moved there in May of 2007, so we're approaching our 15th year.
So I know you have quite a collection then of gambling materials that you've been acquiring over the years. One of the people I want to talk about, and that's Titanic Thompson.
Okay.
Because you and John Rockerbummer, I think, are kind of the experts on his life. Did you ever meet him? You're probably too young to have known him.
Yeah, I think Titanic Thompson died in the 70s. So I was born in 71, but I wouldn't have.
Okay.
I want to say, and you can't quote me on this, but I want to say Titanic Thompson died in like 74 or something. Like that. So I never met him. And I actually don't consider myself an expert on Titanic Thompson. I've read everything I can find about him. You know, there's like three different Titanic Thompson books.
Right.
There's the Unsinkable Titanic Thompson, which was, I believe, the Stowers book, and a couple other. His son wrote one, and one other one, I think, came out here not too long ago. I've read all of those books. I've read the magazine articles on him. I think he's a fascinating character. But I don't consider myself an expert on him because I don't have any information other than what was in those books and a couple of
articles. But you collected some of his paraphernalia.
A few things were given to me by the one guy that I know that met him and spent lots of time around him was a guy named Joe. I won't say Joe's last name because I don't know if he wants me to.
I know who you're talking about, though.
Some magicians know who he is. They've met him before. He's actually come into some magic conventions over the years. So I met Joe at Steve Forte's auction in November of 2009. There was this guy kind of wandering around looking in all the display cases the day before the auction, where everything's laid out. But it wasn't viewing time yet. It wasn't like the preview portion of the auction where the public is allowed in to look. It was the day before that. And there's this guy walking around looking. And I noticed that he's looking at all the good stuff. I mean, he had an eye. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, so this guy's
knows what
he's looking at. You know, he's not just casually looking. He's like studying stuff, trying to get behind the display cases and look underneath things. And, you know, he's taking notes on a piece of paper. And I walked up to him, and I thought he worked there. I thought he worked at the auction house. Mm-hmm. And maybe he was, you know, cataloging some items or something. And I said, I started talking to him a little bit. And I said, so do you work here? Do you work for Peter? And he goes, no. He goes, I'm here for the auction tomorrow. And I go, oh, okay. And, you know, I knew that it wasn't open to the public at that point. But he was a nice guy. And we started chatting. And I was sitting there with Michael Weber was there. And Steve Freeman, I think, was also there, and Norman Beck. We were all in the sort of room together, and Forte was there. He was over and, you know, looking at stuff, setting stuff up. And so Weber and I are talking to this guy, and he introduced himself as Joe. And I said, so, you know, are you a collector? Are you a magician? Are you a gambler? You
know, they didn't know him either.
We didn't know him
nobody
either.
Did.
Yeah,
okay.
Nobody knew him. This is the first time we'd met him.
Yeah.
And he goes, well, you've probably never heard of this guy. But I used to run around with a guy named Titanic Thompson.
And all you guys went.
Well, Weber and I just looked at each other like, what? You know, like, we've heard of him.
Uh-huh.
And I looked at this guy who's in his 60s and I said, wait a minute. You couldn't have run around with Titanic Thompson. He was on trial for murder in the 20s. And he goes, yeah. He goes, but what people don't know is that he lived until the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, and I met him when I was, I think he said, 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
My dad owned a car dealership, and so I got to take cars off the lot with a full tank of gas and drive around sometimes. And even when I was in my own car, I could still go to the car lot and get free gasoline. He goes, so I met Titanic Thompson when I was a young kid, and I became sort of the guy that drove him around. Because even though he was, you know, old then, he was still hustling. He was still trying to get action in you know, wherever he could.
Yeah.
Just in his blood.
He traveled around. I mean, he wasn't like tied to a city or a state. He just kind of was a rambling man.
So this guy drove Titanic around for like the last 10 years of his life. From the time he was like 15 to the time he was about 25
And he heard a lot of stories, I'm sure.
Oh, my God. The stories are great. And I believe about 90% of them because, you know, sometimes you hear someone tell a story and something in the story just rings true.
Mm-hmm.
Like they said just the right thing and you're listening and you're thinking, I don't know if this story is true or not. I don't know if this story is true or not. Wait. Then they just drop the right word or the right phrase or the right moment or they mention the right name and you're like, oh, wait, this story is definitely true.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe's stories are like that. You know, I suspect a couple of them may be embellished a little bit because he's a natural storyteller.
Do you think it was him who was embellishing that or perhaps that as Titanic was telling him the stories, they may not have been all true?
Both. But I think both things are true. I think this when he relates a story.
And time has passed also.
When he relates a story that didn't happen to him, he probably tells it the way he heard it.
Heard
and
it,
so
yeah.
There could be some embellishment there.
Yeah.
But I think when he tells a story, he's a born storyteller. He's a really great storyteller. And so when he tells a story, I think he knows that if we beef this part of the story up a little bit, it'll make for a better story.
Uh-huh.
And I'm all for it. You know, I'm a big believer in, you know, never let the truth get in the way of
a
good story. I absolutely believe that,
mm-hmm.
especially in situations where the veracity of the story doesn't really matter. You know, it's just a good story.
And it's all about cons.
He's great
anyhow.
At that. Yeah.
Can you tell one or two? Remember something that comes to mind?
Yeah, there's a couple of stories that come to mind. So one of the stories that he told was he told stories about moving a sign, which apparently is something that Titanic did all his life. But Joe helped out with this one a couple of times. They would find a sign, a distance marker to a city.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the sign would say 50 miles to Dallas.
Okay.
And they would take that sign.
A road sign from the interstate.
Absolutely, on the interstate. They'd go out in the middle of the night and they'd move that sign, you know, 20 miles closer to the city.
Oh, my gosh.
And then they would arrange to be driving down that road with somebody.
A mark,
a sucker, exactly. And Titanic would say, well, should be in Dallas in 30 minutes. And right as he says that, the guy looks out the window and he sees this sign, 50 miles to Dallas. Well, you're not going to get there in 30 minutes, you know, unless you're doing 120 miles an hour.
Uh-huh.
And so the guy would go, it's going to be closer to an hour before we get to Dallas. And he'd say, no, it's like 30 minutes. We'll be there, right in the middle of town. And
mm-hmm.
the guy's like, no, I just saw the sign. And he goes, no, I bet you. You know, and now the bet's on. I'll bet you this amount of money we're there in 20 minutes. At this speed, I won't go any faster. I'm telling you, I've driven this route before. And they get the bet down, and sure enough, they're in town in 20 minutes, and Ty wins his bet. Now, whether it's $20 or whether it's lunch or dinner, who knows?
Right.
But Joe's moved a couple of signs, he said. And then he had a great one where Titanic, who was a world-class golfer, there's no question about that,
mm-hmm.
Titanic apparently had this bet that he would get down with people where he would say, I can make, you know, a 30-foot or 40-foot cold putt first thing in the morning. I won't take any practice strokes, no practice putting strokes. We'll go out, I'll
Sink
nail this 30-foot putt.
First time.
And, of course, I mean, that's tough to do for the best golfers in the world.
Professional golfer, sure.
Yeah, hard to do. I mean, they'll hit it some of the time, of course.
He's guaranteeing first time.
But he's saying, I'll lay you even money, I'll get it. And every golfer is all over that bet. They're like, I'll take that bet. And so what Titanic would do is he would have Joe take a garden hose.
Oh, yeah.
And they would
lay it out.
They would cap the ends of the garden hose, uh-huh. both ends, but fill it up with water so it had some weight to it.
Yep.
And it would go out, and he'd put one end of the garden hose in the hole,
mm-hmm.
and he'd run the other end 30 feet away to where the putt was going to take in a straight line and just leave it there overnight. And it put this little impression in the in the grass there on the green. And so then Joe would sneak out there early the next morning, pick that hose up, And now you can't really see that impression, but it's there.
Yeah.
And then Titanic would put his ball right at the spot of where the hose started.
Uh-huh.
And really, because it's got this little track that it's running in now,
mm-hmm.
he still executes the best putt he can,
mm-hmm.
but he's got this little self-correcting kind of gutter now
yeah.
that the ball is actually traveling in
uh-huh.
as it goes to the hole.
That's great.
And you know, I'm sure it doesn't make the shot 100%, but it took something that
better than even odds.
Maybe he could do 50% of the time. It took it to now he's going to hit it 70 or 80% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so stuff like that are the kinds of kind of crazy little bets that Titanic would get down and that Joe would help him out with, you know, by gaffing some part of the bet in some way.
Somebody, well, a friend of mine has been collecting some of these. Things that used to belong to Titanic,
mm-hmm.
and I guess they contacted you about this too, like a pretzel, an iron pretzel, mm-hmm. or a peanut, or whatever.
Yeah. Got a lot of that.
Can you talk about some of those?
Yeah. So Titanic was famous for throwing a walnut over a building, and what he had was a walnut that was filled with lead.
Mm-hmm.
He would, you know, drill out the back of a walnut, pour molten lead inside it, seal it back up, And he was genuinely good at all sorts of eye-hand coordination, athletic things, and could throw a walnut farther than anybody, but no one can throw a walnut over a building because it's just mm-hmm. too light. You know,
yeah.
the wind will blow it away if you're not careful.
Mm-hmm.
But he would insist that he could throw a walnut over a building, and again, he'd get these bets down with people, and he'd take his walnut and wind up.
He could pick it up off the ground, basically.
Like, yeah, hey, pick it up off the ground or out of a bucket of walnuts
yeah.
or whatever, and just bet that he could throw one over the building. And, you know, if you've tried to throw a walnut as far as you can, you know it'll go about 30 feet, and that's about
yeah,
it.
Right.
So the idea that somebody could throw one over a building is just kind of preposterous.
Mm-hmm.
But sure enough, Ty would wind up and there it would go, or clean over the building, all the way over the other side of the
yeah.
building, because it was like throwing a rock, you know. It had,
right.
it had some heft to it. And, of course, they would go around behind the building previously, and they would smash a walnut on the ground.
Oh, clever.
And so now if anyone walked back there, they see walnut pieces everywhere, because the actual walnut filled with lead, it would hit and roll another 100 feet, you know. So they never
true.
Found that thing,
sure.
you know. But, you know, of course, there's smashed walnut pieces back there, and so it looked legit.
I never thought about the cleanup on that.
Yeah. So Joe took that old idea of Titanic's, and he used to make walnuts for Titanic to do. And I think at some point the story got to the point where, you know, Ty would give these walnuts away to people almost as like, you know, here's my legendary old con thing. Here, you can have that
yeah.
as a gift.
Uh-huh.
And Joe used to make those. So I have a walnut at home. I suspect Titanic Thompson never touched it,
mm-hmm.
you know. But Joe made it. And since it came from one of Titanic's students, you know, I'm very happy to have it. But Joe sort of did the same thing with bar pretzels, you know, little bitty pretzels, maybe an inch or so in diameter, or a couple inches in diameter.
When I heard about that, I thought they were more like the size of your hand, you know, bigger pretzels.
No, no, they're small bar
oh,
pretzels.
Okay.
And he would make those out of solder. So he would drip molten solder into a pretzel pattern.
Yeah.
And then take it, and he had an artist student, I think an art student friend of his,
mm-hmm.
that would paint them. And then while the paint was still wet, he would sprinkle
salt.
Like rock salt on
yeah.
them. So that looks real.
Sure.
And I'm telling you, from a couple of feet away, you just can't tell. Now, if you get real close, obviously one of them looks different.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, from a couple of feet away, you just can't tell. And that's in, you know, good lighting. So imagine in a bar somewhere
mm-hmm.
where apparently what Joe would do is he would go into a bar and he would make this claim that he was a pitcher in high school. He could throw 108 miles an hour.
Okay.
Well, anyone that knows anything about baseball knows this guy's not ever thrown 108
right.
miles an hour.
Right.
You know, the fastest pitches in the world are 106, 107 ever.
Mm-hmm.
I think Aroldis Chapman may have one of the fastest pitches ever. He's around 106. So you look at this guy that weighs 120 pounds soaking wet,
yeah,
and you're like,
not.
This guy's out of his mind. But he insists he was a pitcher in high school. He can throw anything faster and farther than anyone else in the world. He'll look around for something. He'll see this thing of bar pretzels, and he'll reach in and pick one up and say, I bet I can throw this bar pretzel over the building across the street. Well, his girlfriend, who has pretended not to know him,
mm-hmm.
will say, I'll take that bet.
Okay.
And she goes, I got $100 that says you can't throw that pretzel over the building across
so
the street.
So he's got a shill.
So he's got a shill that's trying to build action. And if they can get, and he go, oh, all right, I ain't doing it for less than $500. You guys are out of your mind. You guys got no gamble in you. I'm not doing it for less than $500. Well, now some, you know, some cowboy will speak up and say, well, I've got $300 that says you can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so now he builds, he builds a pot or builds a tip, so to speak, gets enough action to actually make it worth his while.
Mm-hmm.
And he reaches in, he grabs a handful of pretzels, and he walks outside. And he's munching on the pretzels as he goes. And he gets down and he takes the one and holds it up. And the one I have is a complete pretzel. But Joe told me that he left a little piece out of his pretzel.
Mm-hmm.
And he would sort of glue in a piece of real pet pretzel in its place so that he could reach up and take a bite out of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, a small bite, but he took a little bite out of this pretzel. But the rest of it's still made out of essentially lead.
Yeah.
And he would take it and he would wind back and he would throw that pretzel over the building. And he said you could see it in the streetlights, you know, just sort of glint as it flew off into the night.
It was soaring across.
Yeah. Same thing. They would go back around behind that building and he had smashed a pretzel back there. And he goes and he said my pretzel, because it's still essentially round, it hits and it rolls, you know, 50 feet farther down the alley and no one ever found it.
Wow.
And so he would do that. And he told me enough stories about when he couldn't get enough action, he just wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
He told me stories about hitting a metal roof at one point where it didn't quite clear the building. It hit a metal roof and made some big noise, you know, or hit something behind the building. And it didn't sound like a pretzel hit anything behind
a car or something.
It sounded like he hit a car or something. Yeah. So he's told me enough of those stories that I believe that he did this. You know, I don't believe that this was just a BS story. I think he really did it. I think he's done it a number of times.
And he did it with peanuts, too, you said.
Did it with peanuts, did it with acorns. Yeah, mm-hmm. He told me some stories about, he goes, I once threw one of my acorns into a lake. And he goes, it made the biggest splash I've ever seen in my life because, you know, it's filled with lead.
Sure.
And he goes, I just knew that the guy I was hustling was going to realize that that's no acorn.
Didn't make a splash like that.
But he said the guy never said a word. He paid him off.
Wow.
So, you know, it's the stories like that that make me believe he's not just telling stories, that he's really done this stuff.
Now, those are all small cons, small from the standpoint, small potatoes, you know, free drinks or $100, $500 bucks or whatever like that, as opposed to the big things. I thought it was interesting that you were talking about here at the Magi Fest, again, showing some of these videos of there was something you said. They're still doing this con, and they made, like, you were showing a $700,000 that they had made in Macau or someplace. What was that grift?
So what you're talking about is the dice sliding scam that hit Las Vegas, the Wynn Casino. I guess it's been 4 or 5 years ago now. Mm-hmm. A team of dice sliders from Argentina came into either the Wynn or the Encore. Those are the two casinos that Steve Wynn built there in Vegas. I don't remember if they were actually at the Wynn or if they were at the Encore, but they were at one of his two properties. And they slid the dice, and the estimates run between $400,000 and $700,000 that they won.
Wow.
And
walked out with.
I have heard stories that they were arrested and released, and he did not get the money back. I have heard other people say that they were arrested and they were released because he got some of the money back. I don't really know what the truth is there. I intend to actually ask some people. The World Game Protection Conference is coming up next month in Las Vegas, and I want to ask some people. I said, hey, whatever happened to these Argentinian dice sliders? I know they got the money at the time, but I've heard conflicting reports on whether or not Wynn got some of that money back. I don't really know what the answer is, but I do know that several people were fired. That made the Las Vegas newspapers.
Yeah.
The craps crew and some of the surveillance crew was fired from the
Wynn. It's because they should have seen it. Wasn't they were in on it? It's just they should have seen it.
No, they were not in on it. They should have seen it. Yeah, I mean, it's their job.
Explain it real quickly. It was with the slider. There are two people working in conjunction.
Typically two or more. Yeah, so sliding a die. So we know at a craps table, you're supposed to pick up two dice and throw them through the air.
And it has to hit the end.
Yeah, so that they bounce and tumble, and they're supposed to hit the back wall. Although, if you hit the back wall 95% of the time, no one's going to say anything if you miss the back wall once or twice in an hour. Because that happens, you know.
But they tell you.
But they'll tell you, try to hit the back wall, So, but what a dice slider will do is one die is thrown normally through the air, but the other die is placed onto the table, onto the layout, onto the felt surface, and it is slid down the layout, and it is slid with some spin, so it does not tumble.
Okay.
It just slides down the layout.
Keeping the uppermost.
Yeah, whatever number they put up stays there. So if they put a six up and they slide the die, when it gets to the end of the table, you know, 5, 6, 7 feet away, however far away it is, it still has a six on the uppermost. And all it does is slide. It does not roll over at any point. And this is illegal. Dice sliding is illegal. It's against the rules. Not supposed to do that. And if you slid both dice, it would be obvious. But because one die is actually thrown and it sort of bangs all around the table and bounces and tumbles, you hear dice bouncing and you see one of them bouncing. And by the time your eyes focus in on the other one, it's come to a stop and it can look really good. It can look like both dice tumbled down the table.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is only one of them is tumbling down the table. The other one, you don't realize it was actually sliding.
But how do you, in other words, they throw two dice, but how does this, the one guy who's sliding, does he grab the other one and slide one? So this way, because the croupier is only looking, he's seeing two dice. I mean, I guess I don't understand why. I mean, when they throw the dice, I'm not clear. Do they pick one up and then exchange the die?
Nope. They actually have both in their hand. One is placed on the table between your first finger, second finger, and the other one just flies out of your hand normally.
So the one flies and the one slides, one flies.
One slides and one is thrown through the air.
With you.
Correct.
I got you.
Yep. And you know, if I told you, if I said, "Hey Scott, watch this guy slide this die," you'd see it. You know, it's not invisible. You'd see it. You go, "Oh my gosh, yeah, he sure did. He slid it right down the table." But so what happens is, remember, the stick man, the dealers, the pit boss, not pit boss, the box man sitting at the craps table, they may have been there for 7 hours.
Right. And they're watching hundreds of throws.
They've seen hundreds of dice throws. They're bored out of their minds. You know, they're supposed to be alert, but they're human beings.
And that's why those guys got fired, because they should have been alert.
They're bored out of their minds. Yeah. They're just trying to do their job.
Yeah.
They may have been there 10 years and never seen a dice sliding crew. You know, who knows? And then all of a sudden, a good crew walks up. One guy leans out and distracts the box man with a big buy-in. He goes, "Hey, can I get change for 500? Well, that's a big thing for a craps table in a casino. You got to make change for this guy, because if he doesn't have chips, he's not making any bets. We're not making any money. So let's get this guy some change fast.
Yeah.
You know, so that distracts this guy. He's leaning way out over the table. He's leaned in front of the stick man, so the stick man can't really see the sliding die. He's blocking his view. The whole thing's over in half a second, you know. And it's hard to spot. You know, if I don't tell you, here it comes, you're just not going to see it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't blame these crews for missing one or two slides. I don't blame them at all.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if your team of dice sliders has been there for 10 hours, then something's wrong.
Something's wrong.
You know, but I don't blame a crew for missing a slide here and there.
Right.
They're hard to see, you know, because we're all human beings. And if I walked up to you in a casino, I don't care what your job is, and I go, "Excuse me, sir, where's the restroom?"
Mm-hmm.
You're not just going to hold your arm out and point while staring me in the eyes. You're going to look.
Give directions.
You're going to look in the area. You're going to go, "Sir, it's right down there." Well, that's all it took. That half a second when you looked away is all it took for us to slide that die, you know.
Right.
And so, so when the box man who makes change 100 times a day, when a guy leans over and says, "Can I get change?" That doesn't mean anything to him. That's not a signal that a scam is in play. That's just a good way of getting his attention for half a second.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy at the other end of the table zips that die down the layout, and it's over.
Wow.
You know, so.
Now, do you consult with casinos and look for these kinds of things?
I have, but I don't do it a lot.
You don't do it like C40 does?
No, not at all. I mean, Steve was the best in the world at it. I have done a handful of consulting gigs over the years.
Mm-hmm.
I do not go looking for that type of work. I don't advertise myself to casinos.
Do they come looking for you, though?
Yeah, they'll come to me. And so what normally happens is I am a second opinion. So just like if you went to the doctor and you got some diagnosis, where he says, "Well, Scott, we're going to have to chop your arm off."
Yeah.
You'd be like, "I want to talk to somebody else." So before you do anything like that, you go on a second opinion or a third opinion or whatever. So most of the time, if someone is talking to me, they've already caught somebody. They've mm-hmm. already found something that doesn't sit right with them. They either see someone they suspect is doing something, or maybe they've actually caught and arrested someone, and they've actually got them on some charge.
Right.
But before you go to a prosecutor, before you go to a trial, you want to make sure that you've got it right. So they'll come to me and say, hey, we arrested this group for cheating. We think they cheated us 11 times. We want you to watch these 5 hours of videotape and tell us, do you see 11 cheating attempts, or do you see more than that? Do you see less than that? Mm-hmm. What do you see on this video? And so I'll give them a quote for my time and, you know, my expertise. And if we come to an agreement, I'll watch the videotape. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'll go, yeah, 11 is the right number. You've got 11 cheating counts there mm-hmm. that you could move forward with and prosecute. Other times, I had one guy that they didn't accuse him of cheating. They didn't know what he was doing. He was up like $3 million at one of their blackjack tables.
Right.
And they said, we've got 30 hours of video of this guy playing blackjack.
And we don't know what he's doing.
He's crushing us, and we have no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
This was a Native American casino, and they said, before we go to the Native American Council mm-hmm. and tell them that we don't think he's cheating, we just think he's lucky, would you back us up? Would you be our second opinion?
Yeah.
So this was like 30 hours of footage I had to watch.
Yeah.
And so I was like, yeah, I mean, this is going to be expensive because you're asking for 30 hours of my time,
right.
you know. But yes, I will watch it all. And what you basically do is you list every possible way of cheating at blackjack you can think of, and you systematically cross them off the list. You know, mm-hmm. it's like, well, it's obvious he's not switching the cards. We can cross that off. Well, it's obvious he's not, you know, it's obvious the dealer's not in on it because he's played against 15 different dealers in the last month. We can cross that off the list. It's obvious he's not doing this. We can cross that off. And when you cross everything off, the thing you're left with is it appears this guy is just lucky.
Yeah.
And that was my assessment. I could not see any indication he was cheating. Now, he was betting table maximum. He was betting $10,000 a hand. So $10,000 a hand to be up almost $3 million is not that unusual.
But you got to look at their finances, I think, coming into it. In other words, what were they worth? Were they worth $1 billion?
Oh, yeah. This guy was loaded. I mean, he was a millionaire.
Okay.
But the point is, if you said, hey, I'm a $10 bettor.
Yeah.
And I'm up $3,000 at the blackjack table, no one would think you were cheating. They would just be like, oh, good for you.
Yeah.
Great.
Exactly.
You know, so at the levels he was betting, $10,000 a hand, he was up $3 million.
Wow.
And that's very lucky, but mm-hmm. it's not so crazily lucky that you immediately assume cheating. You know, mm-hmm. it's not like he was up $300 million.
Then
Then you'd be like, well, something's going on. So we sort of systematically crossed everything off the list. I wrote a big, long report. And I said, in my opinion, this guy's not cheating you. If he is cheating you, it's a massive conspiracy.
Yeah.
With, you know,
a long con.
15 of your dealers must be in on this.
Yeah.
And probably some of your floor personnel and surveillance. You know, if he's cheating you, this is a massive conspiracy. My guess is he's not cheating you at all. He's very lucky. He's made some mistakes in his play from a basic strategy point of view.
But it worked out for him.
And sometimes they work out for him. Sometimes they don't. I think the guy's just lucky. I would continue to monitor his play. And he seems like a really good customer. I'd leave him alone. If this was my property and he was my customer, I'd leave him alone.
Did he even know he's being looked into?
I don't know if he did or not.
Okay.
He may have felt some of the heat because I'm sure he had people come down and watch him play in
open
person.
Shoulder, yeah.
You know, so he may have felt some of that heat. Maybe he didn't care. Maybe he didn't know. I don't know. I don't even remember the guy's name.
So ultimately, he got to keep it. And
they let him play.
Yeah.
And the report I got about 6 months later is that he lost about 90% of it back to them in the next couple of months.
Okay.
So this was just a wild swing of good fortune for him, you know, and that was good. So I'm glad they didn't, like, you know, yank him off the back of the stool and haul him into the back room, you know. So,
well, it seems like I recall some years ago at Magic Live when Bill Malone had Steve Forte and Ron Conley, I believe, was there, and they were talking, and it seems like that Steve had said a story similar to that in which he was called overseas someplace, South Africa or wherever. Anyhow, he's looking at a casino. They said, well, this guy had won all this money, and we want to find out if he's cheating. They were paying him a lot of money to come in and do all this, and at the end of the day, it's kind of like, nope, he was just lucky. It's like, okay, well, you know, they ended up paying the guy plus playing his fee, you know, yeah, for that. And sometimes that's the case.
It happens.
Yeah. Yeah. But I thought it was interesting also when you were showing some of the slides of the gambling materials and things that you had looked at, this one particular thing about cards in which they had said there were other people who had looked at it and they had said they couldn't see the cards, but then you were. And I like the way you were looking at it, saying they were not wrong. They just eliminated the things that I would have already looked at.
Yeah. They saved me a bunch of time.
Saved you time.
Yeah, this was a group of magicians at the Magic Castle that were trying to find marks on a deck of cards. Mm-hmm. And the guy that, you know, this happened to that told me this story said, I took a couple decks up to the castle and I handed them out to these magicians.
Who should know.
And we looked at them for, you know, a half hour and none of us could find any marks. And so already he's given me some clues as to if these cards are marked, it won't be obvious because obviously five or six pairs of eyes have looked at them and didn't see anything. So It's clearly not an obvious mark. So that eliminates some things. That saves me some time. I don't have to look for obvious stuff.
Right.
And so I kind of, because he told me that, I saved myself some time. I saved myself 5 or 10 minutes of searching for stuff that ultimately would not be there. And so I had a kind of an epiphany. I was like, you know what? I'm going to look for this thing first. And I looked for that first. And that's actually what it was. So it's not me. It's not a situation where I'm smarter than everybody else. That's absolutely not the case. It is the case that he perceived it that way. He's like, oh my God, you found this in 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. And we looked for half an hour. And I was like, yeah, but I had an advantage. You told me what you looked for and you said it wasn't there. So I didn't waste my time looking for that stuff.
Right. Brilliant.
I would have looked for that stuff first too, you know? And so he perceived it as I was so much smarter than these guys. And that is not the case. I started off with a head start. I knew what not to waste my time looking for. So I looked for something else. And sure enough, there it was. And the other thing is that he showed me how he handed cards out to everyone. And he gave out individual cards to these. He's like, here, you take one, you take one, you take one, you take one. Right. If anyone sees anything funny, let me know. Well, the cards are unmarked individually. They are marked compositionally. It's only when you put them together. So, for instance, if all of the cards, if you took a deck of cards and all the high cards had blue backs, mm-hmm. and all the red or all the low cards had red backs, and you give somebody an individual playing card and say, is there a mark on the back of this? The answer is no. That card is fine, but it's in the blue back category, so that means it's a high card, you know. But if you're only looking at one of them, you wouldn't realize.
And that's
that.
All you need sometimes to have that advantage.
Yeah, absolutely. So he had a deck of cards. He had several decks of cards that were cut. The edges were cut in such a way that high cards came from one deck. And low cards came from another deck. Now, of course, the decks were the same color.
They're B decks.
But the B decks, they had been cut in such a way that the diamond pattern on the backs, right at the very edges of the cards, was different from high card to low cards. Mm-hmm. It's actually more than that. It wasn't just highs and lows. It was actually like aces, kings, and queens looked had a certain pattern. Jacks and tens and nines had another pattern. Eights, sevens, sixes, and fives, I think, had another pattern. And then fours, threes, and deuces had a pattern. So it was actually a four-way combination.
Were they cut that way or printed that way?
They came from different decks. Oh. So we take the aces, kings, and queens from one deck. We take the, you know, the jacks through nines or mm-hmm. whatever, jacks through tens from another deck. Mm-hmm. And you mix them all together. And the deck looks normal to a casual player.
I see.
But the edge cut around each one of those categories is slightly different. So if I look down and I see a row of diamonds across the short end of the deck, I know it's either an ace, king, or queen. I don't know which it is, but it's either an ace, king, or queen. And then on the next card, I see a row of diamonds going down the long side mm-hmm. of the deck. I go, oh, well, this must be, five, six, or seven. You know, again, I don't know which, but I know it's in that category. And so it's called a sort deck. And you make a sort deck by buying about a dozen decks of cards and just sort of looking through them until you find some combinations that work for you, and you make a deck like that.
Yeah.
And so that's what this guy was doing. That's what his uncle was doing, you know, 30 years ago or so.
That was one of the first things I would think of is when I look at a card and say, well, you see the markings, first thing to do is to kind of riffle through the deck to kind of see if there's a flutter or some change or something, you know, in that.
Yeah.
But if you're being handed one card.
Yeah, exactly. You can't do that.
You can't do that.
And that's what he told me. He says, I handed everybody a playing card and said, look for a mark. Yeah. Well, they're looking for, like, you know, a scratch mark on the back or, you know, some ink that's been applied to the back where you're blocking out a portion of the white scroll work. That's the kind of thing they were looking for. And that's what gave me the head start. I knew if they were looking for that, they would have found it. You know, one of them would have found it. And so I was pretty sure that if it was going to be a mark, it was going to be something subtle. So I did not bother looking for the obvious stuff.
Well, you have a lot of things in your collection. Is there something, and you've probably been asked this a dozen times by other people, of something that is favorite or that I assume you buy, trade, and sell or some other things, but some things like, I really want to keep this. This means something to me. I mean, it seems to me that you really are fascinated by holdouts, and I can understand why. Is it a holdout, or is there some other little piece? I know you have, like, pencils and dice and all kinds of things, you know, that are gambling things. But is there something that is like, this is, you know, is there something that you're looking for that is a holy grail for you that I wish I could find? I've heard about thing exists.
There's dozens of those things. as far as a favorite item, so I was very, very close to a guy named Rod the Hop, who was a...
He just died like 4 years ago?
It was a little bit longer than that. It was 7 or 8 years ago now.
Boy, time flies.
2013? Yeah, he died in December of 2013. So what is that, 9 years ago?
Yeah, and it's 22 now.
Or 8 years. Yeah, whatever. It's been a while. So Rod and I were like brothers the last 10 years of his life.
I didn't know you were that close.
Okay. Yeah, we were just super close. He was a great friend. He gave me, when he died, he gave me his Keplinger holdout that he actually used in games, you know, 30 years ago. That would be sort of a prized possession.
For a variety of reasons.
It's a cool piece, but, you know, it came from him.
It was used by him.
Yeah, used by him, came from him. He wanted me to have it. And so that would definitely be a prized sort of piece in my collection. I've got a couple of books that exist in very small numbers in the world. I've got one book that I believe is the only copy in the world. I've got another book that we know of two other copies in the world. One of them's in an institution. The other one's in private hands. I have the third one that's ever surfaced.
Are we talking about Erdnase?
No. There's 100 first edition Erdnases in the world, at least, because I keep a list of them.
Okay. We'll get to that in just a minute, but go ahead with what. So what books are these? These are gambling books?
Yeah, they're little gambling books. One of them predates Erdnase. It's called Koschitt's Manual of Useful Information, published in 1897.
It was intended for gamblers?
Yeah. It's got some cool stuff in it. It's got some stuff in it that's not in Erdnase, even though it came out before Erdnase. Mm-hmm. I've told this story before. I paid like $50 for it on eBay. Mm-hmm. And a month later, Gabe Fahuri, who owns Potter & Potter Auctions, sold the other known copy that's in private hands for $8,000. I paid $50 for mine.
Wow.
Yeah, so I got lucky. I got real lucky.
You think?
So I have one of only two known to exist in private hands.
Yeah.
Paid $50 for it. It's in great shape.
Hmm.
So that was like one of my biggest scores ever on eBay. Where
you need to meet that person and in person and take them to lunch or something.
Exactly, yeah. So the other little booklet that I have is called... The Art of Reading Cards While Dealing, or the Secret of Reading Cards While Dealing. Sorry, The Secret of Reading Cards While Dealing. And it's a little bitty manuscript. It's a yellow cover, little manuscript. And it's all on how to peek at cards while you're dealing them across the table, how to secretly look at them when you're not supposed to. And as soon as I got it, first of all, I'd never heard of it. And it was published in the 20s. And if I've never heard of it, that means it's not common, because I've heard of most of the books, even if I don't have them, I've heard of them. I'd never heard of this. And I thought, well, that's weird. So I buy it. I look through it. And I was like, this is great. This is it's only like 15 pages long. But this is a cool little manuscript. I love this. And so I called all the major collectors that I know of. I called Byron Walker. I called Andy Greggett. I called Terry Rose's. I called Bill Kalush. And I'm like, hey, what can you guys tell me about the secret of reading cards while dealing? Little pamphlet from the 20s. Not only did none of them have it, none of them had ever heard of it. That's how uncommon it is. You know, Byron Walker's got 100,000 magic books in his house. He's never even heard of this book. You know it's uncommon.
And you came across that on eBay? Or
came across it in an auction at Potter & Potter. So the only person I know of that ever owned it was the guy that actually consigned it to that auction.
True, Gabe,
A guy named Bob Rosenberger, who was a very advanced collector until he sold pretty much all of his stuff at auction
was
several years
ago. Was it gaming things that he collected? All gambling
stuff. For the most part, yeah. So I have that book, and as far as I can tell, and if you search for it online, like if you could do a Google search for that title, you get nothing except for Gabe's auction. It's like the book doesn't exist until that auction. So my guess is it was a little pamphlet printed up by one of the gambling supply houses back in the 20s. They may have made 100 copies of it in 1925, and this is the only one left. That's my best guess as to what happened. I honestly don't know because, again, there's zero information about this book.
Maybe there really wasn't a big market for that kind of thing at the time, too.
I don't even think it has a price on it. I don't remember if it has a price. It might have been a giveaway.
I was about to say, it could have been a giveaway
Something they just handed out, you know, and they printed a handful of them, and that was it.
For that month. Maybe every month.
Who knows? Mm-hmm. But as far as I know, I've got the only one in existence. And I'm sure there's another one out there somewhere, but no one seems to have run across it.
Well, now going to Erdnase, you say as far as first editions, they come up for auction from time to time and they...
Oh, two or three a year.
Okay.
Yeah, that is not a rare book. People think...
It's not like Discovery of Witchcraft.
No, people think first edition Erdnases are rare. They're not rare. They're just expensive. You know, Lamborghinis aren't rare. If you want 10 of them tomorrow,
if you got the money.
Yeah, get $3 million, we'll go buy 10 of them tomorrow. They're not rare at all. They're just expensive.
Yeah, you can find them.
First edition Erdnases are the same way. They are not rare. Rare means, you know, that there's a small number of them. And in the bookselling world, most people use the word rare to mean like less than a dozen copies. That's a rare book.
Yeah.
If there's only 10 or a dozen copies known, that's rare. You know, and they're not hard and fast rules for these. But, you know, if there's two dozen copies or three dozen copies, they typically say scarce. Scarce and then rare. And then, of course, unique means there's only one copy, obviously. It's hard to know if you have a unique copy of something, but you can suspect it. But Erdnase, first edition Erdnases don't fall into that category. I know of at least 100 of them. I don't know where all of them are, but I used to track them along with Richard Hatch. He did the bulk of the work. He had about 80 of them on his list when he gave me that list years ago.
How many were printed in the first run? Do you know?
We don't know. We have no idea. But, you know, he had tracked down 80 first editions and knew where most of them were. And I've added about 20 to that over the years. And so there's about 100 of them, we think, that are circulating. And that's not a rare book. But when you're getting $10,000 a copy or $15,000 a copy, like Gabe Ferhuri is getting at his auctions. Depending on condition, 9,000 to 12,000, 13,000, 14,000has been about the price of them for the last 4 or 5 years.
Are they mainly book collectors or are they magicians who are
all magicians. I don't think actual book collectors are, it's not even on their radar.
That's what I thought.
But I think these are all magicians that are buying it. And I bought I have three first editions. I bought my first one in 2004 and paid $750 for it. And it's in great shape. And so the price has just gone through the roof since
then.
Why, you think? You know, I don't really know. That's a great question. I'm sure that my popularizing the book has got a little bit to do with that. I certainly don't think I'm completely responsible for it by any means, but I think I helped popularize the collecting of the different first editions. There's a guy named John Bodine that lives in the Bay Area. He has probably as many as I do. He's got several first editions, and he likes the different editions of the book just like I do. I think John Bodine helped popularize the collecting of these books. You know, Erdnase just sort of kind of filtered into or bubbled back up to the surface again in the minds of a lot of card magicians in the last, 20 years or so.
And how many editions have there been that you know?
I don't know. You can get
just
really
in English. I mean,
you can get really down into the weeds into that. I mean, I've got three. So first of all, the word edition is a tricky word because the author never changed his text. So in a sense, every Erdnase you've ever seen is a first edition.
Because it's just a reprint of the same
thing. Yeah, because he didn't change the text. So the text is the same.
Oh.
So booksellers, book collectors typically use edition to mean when did the author change the text. So if you alter the text in a significant way, that's a second edition.
Otherwise, it's a reprint.
It's a printing, yes. First printing, first edition, first printing.
Yeah.
And then first edition, second printing, first edition, so third printing.
So technically, this is first edition, 32nd.
Exactly, printing. Yeah. So they're all, from a rare book collector's perspective, they're all first editions. Huh. They're just printing variants. Huh. But most people, when they say, do you have a first edition Erdnase, what they mean is first edition, first printing.
Yeah.
And so I know what they mean. So if you say, do you have a first edition Erdnase? I know what they mean. And most people know what they mean. Yes, we're talking about the green hardback first edition, first printing, printed by McKinney and Company out of mm-hmm. Chicago. That's what everyone's talking about. And so you'll sometimes hear me say, oh, I have some of the second editions. And what I'm talking about is the hardback copies that Drake printed starting in 1905 and probably running for about a decade or so after that. Hmm. I say second edition all the time. I know that technically that's not the accurate way to say it.
It's really the second printing,
but
I guess.
Exactly. It's really the second printing. Okay. But I say second edition, and most people know what I'm talking about. So I use that term all the time.
How do you know the difference between the first and the second? Is it say so on the inside plate?
No, they look completely different.
Oh, okay.
So the second printings that Drake did starting in 1905, they're smaller hardbacks. They have a pictorial cover. There's like some hands and a playing cards.
Well, I thought that was from the first one. Didn't
on
have
the hands.
That?
No, the first one's just a green hardback with gold text on the cover. Mm-hmm. It just says the expert at the card table.
Mm-hmm.
So Drake put out like, I think I've got seven of those small Drake hardbacks, seven mm-hmm. different colors. The pattern is the same on them, but it's about seven different colors.
But they're not all green.
In fact, only one of them is green.
Okay.
I suspect, and I can't prove this, but it's happened in other books too. But I think when Drake went to print his, that second printing in 1905, he probably said, "All right, we're going to do a run of these books. Bring me some boards." And they brought, let's say they're going to do 1,000 copies. I'm just making that number up.
Yeah.
They bring him 600 green boards.
Mm-hmm.
They bring him, 250 gray boards. And they bring him whatever's left, another 150 or so blue boards. That's just what they have. Mm-hmm. That's just what's in the back room. That's what's in stock. So I don't think he intended to just do one print run. I think that's just what they had.
Hmm.
And you see that in other books. So like a first edition Huckleberry Finn. If you get on eBay and you find a first edition Huckleberry Finn, they come in green, blue, and I think red. And they're all considered first editions. Mm-hmm. They were all sort of printed at the same time. And I think no one really knows how many of each color was printed because it's just whatever the printer and binder had on hand at the time, that's just the boards that they used. I suspect that's what happened with Drake. And so there's no way to say, well, the blue one's the true second and the green one's the third. There's just no way to do that. It's impossible.
They just use whatever and then they grabbed
whatever.
Whatever
they had lying around, that's just what they grabbed. And they hot stamped them with the image of the hands and the cards. And they stamped the title on the spine. And that was it. They just printed them up and they didn't really care what colors. That's my supposition. I can't prove this. It's just what I think. And most of the people that I've talked about, Richard Hatch and Bill Mullins and John Bodie, we're all kind of in agreement that mm-hmm. this is the most likely scenario.
Well, there's been a lot of interest, obviously, about who Erdnase was, and we could talk again about that for a long time. Mm-hmm. And you've got lectures on that and everything then, too. But I know there have been at least a couple of attempts, which I've helped pay for in a Kickstarter, for some mm-hmm. movies that have tried to do that. What is the status of any of those kinds of film projects that you've heard of, documentaries, et cetera?
I don't know what the current status is.
I've seen that you were part of some
I've been involved in it, but the director who I believe is also the producer of the film, reached out to me a couple of years ago.
Is that the one in Germany?
The one in Germany, yeah. Correct. He sent a film crew to my house. He was actually unable to get a visa, so he had to stay in Germany, the director, and we did the interview over Zoom, and I'm just sort of talking to camera while he's asking me questions over, you know, a Zoom call of some sort or Skype or whatever it was. And I haven't heard from him since. I mean, he was very nice. He was polite. He said, thank you. I'm going to take this footage and go make this film.
Right.
I have not had really any contact from him since then. So I have no idea what the status of the movie is, other than I saw a trailer. The trailer came out maybe a month ago.
I saw that on Instagram or someplace. Yeah.
So I think the trailer is out, which means they've clearly been working on this ever since then.
Right.
But if you ask me when it's coming out, I've got no idea. If you ask
You're not in the loop.
Yeah, I'm just not in the loop, you know, but I'm not supposed to be in the loop. I was just kind of a hired interviewer that day.
Right.
You know, I have nothing to do with the financing of it. I've never even looked at the Kickstarter, you know, so I really don't know. I just, you know, he sent the crew over. He asked me some questions for an hour or so, and that was the last I heard from him. But he's very nice. I mean, I think it'll eventually come out. He's a nice guy.
I did a podcast with him, and we talked about that at length. But as I recall, when I was talking with him, he said there was yet another one either that had started or was going to be going. That's why I wondered if there were a couple.
Oh, yeah. I don't know.
So you've only talked to the one?
I think so.
Okay.
But
I know you talked.
I've done this so many times. It's like, you know, I did. I was on Richard Turner's Delt documentary, so that crew came to the house.
Yeah.
I've been involved in some other documentaries over the years, so they all kind of run together in my head a little bit. But I'm pretty sure I only talked to one film crew. And if I'm wrong about that, I apologize. But I think I only remember one film crew, which was this guy from Germany.
I can't pronounce his name. Started with a B or something.
Yeah, I have it in my email. Yeah. I don't remember either. But like I said, I never met him in person because we did the interview over Zoom. But really nice guy. Asked good questions, I thought. You know, a lot of his questions were insightful. You can tell he really cares about this. And I look forward to seeing the documentary, but I'm going to watch it with all the rest of you because, you know, I've never seen it.
As I recall, what he was talking about doing with this film was going to be a little bit different, in which everyone has these different theories as to who Erdnase was. And so they were going to follow one guy and have a little bit. I mean, there was actually actors, you know, that are going through, and then they'll have another scenario. This could have happened. Then they'll have another scenario. This could have happened.
Sure.
Because there are so many different things, as you know, about the height of the guy because of what the artist had said, or one thing or the other. So, and when he met him and all these kinds of things. And so who was he and what did he actually do? And it seems like the Dick Hatch had a handle on who he thought he was. So let me ask you that. Who do you think Erdnase was?
I don't have a good answer. So Richard Hatch and I are friends. We've been friends for years. I think he is the preeminent Erdnase authorship scholar in the world. And I defer to Dick Hatch a lot of the time with details. Like I'll call him up and go, hey, I know you'll remember this. I don't remember. And then I'll ask him some question. He always has it, right on the tip of his tongue. Yeah. He just knows it. So he's amazing with the research that he's done. So if I had to bet on a candidate that we are on to right now, like one of the named candidates, if I had to bet, first of all, I don't want to bet.
Yeah.
So I'm not comfortable with any of them completely. But if you said, Jason, you have to place your wager, I would bet on Dick Hatch's candidate because he's got the name right. S.W. Erdnase spelled backwards is E.S. Andrews. All right. It seems very reasonable that we're looking for an E.S. Andrews who was in or around Chicago in 1901. The book was published in February of 02. That's when the Library of Congress received their copy. So at least one of them had been printed by February of 02. So we're looking for an author named or a person named E.S. Andrews in and around Chicago in the winter of 1901 into the early winter of 1902 who was approximately this age range. You know, we don't have a specific age for the author, but an age range based on the illustrator's recollections. We have an approximate height, weight, you know, that sort of thing. And Hatch's candidate meets all of that criteria. So does that mean it's the guy? Absolutely not. Does not mean that's the guy. Who else are you going to bet on? You know, there is nobody else that meets all of those criteria. To find anyone else, you have to change something. Most of them change the name. You know, the candidate that was initially put forth by David Alexander and a gentleman from Montana named Marty Demarest kind of picked up that mantle and ran with it. That guy's name is Wilbur Edgerton Sanders. Mm-hmm. So there, to get to Wilbur, we got to change the name. We've got to go. Oh, it wasn't E. S. Andrews. It was an S W E, and we can mix that around
kind of
to come up with W E S. It's William Edgerton Sanders is who Erdnase was. I'm like, yeah, whatever. You know, that seems a bit of a stretch to me. Yeah. You know, why are we playing with the letters of the name when we've got a perfectly good E. S. Andrews in Chicago in 1901? The right age, the right height and weight, and you know, that sort of stuff. Why are we even looking anywhere else? You'd have to come with a really strong case and telling me that.
So Dick's search is done. That's it, guy.
I know he's had
a couple different people.
It's not done, but that's his favorite candidate. Okay. And again, if I had to bet, that's who I'm betting on. Mm-hmm. Everyone else is a stretch.
Yeah.
You know, everyone else, you have to change some fundamental aspect of what I just told you, name, height, weight, that sort of thing.
Right.
And I see no reason to change those things. Those changes are not driven by evidence. Those changes are driven by a desire to fit your candidate to the book.
Sure.
And maybe they're right. You know, maybe Todd Carr's candidate, who I won't say, but I know who his candidate is. We've had some nice conversations about that. Maybe Todd Carr's nailed it. Maybe when his book comes out, I'll read it and go, wow, Todd, this is the guy. You nailed it. Mm-hmm. Maybe I won't, but
you're still open.
I'm still open, but I just see no reason to look at anyone else yet from an evidence point of view. And again, I've not seen Todd's evidence, so I have to withhold judgment in fairness to Todd. I have to withhold judgment until I see his evidence. But I'm looking for an E.S. Andrews in or around Chicago in 1901, who's this age range and this height and weight range, and Dick Hatch has that guy.
Yeah,
I'm not saying my search is over, and Dick Hatch is not saying the search is over, but I am telling you, if I had to place my wager today, that's the guy I'm putting my money on.
Fair enough.
Now, the truth is, it's very possible that none of the candidates that any of us are looking at are the guy. It could be someone that's completely off everyone's radar. And, of course, we just have no way of knowing that, but it's possible.
Right.
I'd say it's maybe 30% likely that none of us have stumbled on the guy yet. Very possible. Not just a pipe dream, but like very possible that nobody's on to the right person yet.
It's one of those questions, I guess, after an eternity. It's like, you know, who killed Kennedy and who was Erdnase?
Yeah. Well, you know what? Unless
we may never know.
Unless someone comes up with a contract with a name and address on it from McKinney and Company or from Drake, we're never going to know, you know. I don't believe it's really – I mean, look, it's possible, but I do not think that we will ever settle this. I think people will make their minds up.
Yeah.
But I don't think you'll ever be able to go, here's rock solid proof that no one would dispute. Mm-hmm. Here's a signed contract by E.S. Andrews that lived at this address in Chicago. Here's the signed contract with McKinney. Here's the signed contract with Drake. That's the only way I think everyone would go, yep, you found him, you know.
And this is the last mystery of magic, I think. And that's why I think it's interesting to magicians, then, because there are so many other things that we know how tricks are done, but that's the one thing that no one has settled.
It's a big mystery, certainly. I mean, there could be other mysteries out there in other areas of magic I just don't know about, of course.
Right.
But yeah, it's a big mystery. It's fun. I mean, the idea that this guy wrote a book that has been – that we're still talking about 100 years later.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, and maybe there are, but, you know, are stamp collectors obsessing over some stamp collecting book that's 120 years old?
I bet they do.
You know, are there people in, you know, other areas that are obsessing over mysterious authors in other areas. I don't know. Maybe there are, but we've got ours. You know, we've got Erdnase.
Well, so that all ties together, certainly. Yeah. Erdnase, and then also with gambling and everything that you've got. And so we kind of come a full circle over there. And so I tell you what, as we conclude over here, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word, and I always like to conclude by asking my guests, what is it that your philosophy of life, what's your magic word? Not necessarily a word, but Could be a phrase or a statement. What do you live by? What's important to you?
Wow, that's heavy duty. I don't really have
a philosophy that you live by.
Like not in the magic world, certainly. I mean,
no, it could be just your life.
In life,
yeah.
Well, it's just to, to have a good time with good people is what
that's
I try
what
to do.
For.
Try to do every day. But I will tell you something that I actually wrote about. I mean, I'm not trying to pitch anything because this is for free. But if you read the Magi Fest, the little notebook that they gave us all
yeah.
here today.
Uh-huh.
There's something in there that I just wrote a couple weeks ago. They asked me to write something, and mm-hmm. I wrote about this. And it does have to do with magic, so I'll briefly sort of try to encapsulate it for you. About 2 months ago, I'm listening to satellite radio,
mm-hmm.
and little Steven Van Zandt,
yeah, mm-hmm.
Who is the lead guitarist for Bruce Springsteen
yeah.
E Street Band.
Yeah.
And he also...
He's a movie star, too.
Yeah, he was also in The Sopranos.
Sopranos, yeah.
So... little Steven Van Zandt was being interviewed on the radio, and I was listening to it and driving. I wasn't paying real close attention to the interview, but I was listening to it, and he made this wonderful comment that I immediately went, oh my God, that's so applicable to magic. It's not even funny. He said that in every Bruce Springsteen show,
mm-hmm.
they try to transport, transcend, and they try to transform their audiences.
Hmm.
And he didn't go into a lot of details, but I immediately knew
need.
What he meant.
Yeah.
Transport your audience. They want to take them to another place in their memory
mm-hmm.
when things were better, when things were great. You know,
yeah.
they want to transport you to this cool
old boyfriends and girlfriends.
Yeah, this nostalgia place. And I thought, wow, that's great. And then they want to transcend. They want it to be the best show that these people have ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
They want it to, you know, to really take them to forgive the kind of weird expression, but, you know, they want to take them to a higher place of consciousness or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Sure.
And then they want to transform. They want to leave their audience better than they found them.
They want to put
a smile on their face as they're going out the door. And I thought, wow, what a wonderful thing for magic. You know, I want my magic to transport you maybe to a time when you were younger. Maybe not necessarily to a time when you were younger, but maybe to a place of like childlike wonder.
Mm-hmm.
That would be fun. I want it to transcend. I want it to be better than anything you've seen in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want my stuff to transcend what you thought was possible with a deck of cards or
mm-hmm.
transcend what you thought you knew about gambling. And I want it to transform you. I want you to be a different person after you've sat with me. Not in any huge, meaningful, life-altering way, but for the rest of their lives, after people see me do stuff with a deck of cards, every time they see a deck of cards, I want them to think of me. That they have been transformed in a small way. They're a different
Right.
They're a different person for having watched me
Love
handle
it.
A deck of cards. Just like you would be a different person if you watched, you know, some great artist do something right in front of you,
right.
you would be different. You know, if someone sculpted a beautiful statue in front of you, whenever
mm-hmm.
you saw the subject of that statue again the rest of your life, you'd think of that statue, you would think of that artist.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this is happening in small ways because I get people email me all the time that'll say, hey Jason, I saw your show 2 years ago and you did, you know, all this wonderful stuff for us. And my buddies and I were playing poker last night and I started to wonder if this was possible. And so here you've got a situation where someone who I don't really know saw me 2 years ago, but when gambling came up in their lives, they thought back to me.
Mm-hmm.
That person's been transformed. Now, it's a small thing. You know, I didn't improve their life for the better, but they're a different person now because they got to see my show. And I love that, you know, and I love helping. I love getting those questions. I don't always have answers for them,
yeah.
but I love getting those questions because it means they remembered me when gambling or cheating or poker or something came up in their life or magic.
Thing. You know, sometimes you know. People hear music, they'll have a scent that they smell or something that they
yeah.
see that will remind them of something
yep.
that was a better time or somebody. Like there's a song by U2, and whenever I hear this and I think of David Copperfield, for an
mm-hmm.
example, that he had done, and different things like this, that people, they become so ingrained.
What's the song?
Disassociate. It'll come to me. but I still haven't found what I'm looking for. What is that called?
I still haven't found what I'm looking for. Is the second song on the Joshua Tree album.
Okay, is it on the Joshua Tree?
1987.
It's just one of the reasons I remember that is because he was doing the Walter Blaney's Ladder Levitation, and Walter was like a father to me. Mm-hmm. And so, and I was thinking, you know, as they were playing that, I thought, that's a great illusion, but I still haven't found what I'm looking for until they found Flying. And then he found Flying, it's like, I found it.
Right.
So that was what I'm saying is like, when I hear that, it's like, at that time, he still hadn't found what he was looking for.
Right.
So I think of Copperfield when I hear that song.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Great.
Speaking of Steve Van Zandt, and I'll let you go, for people who are looking for Netflix recommendations, there was a fantastic series that he was in called Lilyhammer.
Okay.
It was a 2-season thing. First season was great. Second season, you could forget. But it was okay. But it was something worth watching.
Oh, yeah.
It's called Lilyhammer.
I loved him in The Sopranos, so I'll definitely check
same kind of character.
That out.
And I'll tell you, from the very beginning, like in the first few minutes, basically he was a stool pigeon. And after he turned on the mob, the FBI said, okay, we're going to have to move you someplace. Where do you want to go? And he said, I want to go to Lilyhammer. And so he traveled overseas, you know.
Gotcha.
But then he started this thing up again. You got to see it.
I'll check it out for sure.
It's a great one to see.
Great.
Jason, thank you very much. This has
no
been
problem.
Fantastic. I love what you had said, you know, and in quoting Steve Van Zandt as well for that. And golly, this has gone just really quickly, and I'm glad we finally got a chance to get together.
I was thinking,
next time I'm going to get to Vegas, I'm definitely going to talk with you. But then I thought, well, you're here. This is great. Yeah. And so thanks for your time.
No problem. Thanks a lot, man.
So that was Jason in England for the Magic Word Podcast. This is Scotty out.
Wow. Well, thank you very much, Jason. That was just great. We had just a wonderful conversation there. It was chock full of so much information and so many really cool stories. Thank you for sharing all of that. It was great. Just real quickly, since this podcast has gone on a little bit longer than what we typically do, I just want to remind everybody to go back and to enter the contest for a chance to win one of 3 ebooks called The Self-Working Trick, available from John Gaspard. That contest is going to run just for another week, and once it's over, we'll be announcing the winners in next week's podcast. So be sure to go to themagicwordpodcast.com for this week's episode or last week's episode, and there will be a form. And that form will disappear after this contest is over, so you won't be able to enter after March the 9th, I believe, will probably be the last time we're going to take a look at that spreadsheet and then draw a winner. So, until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to try to transport, transcend, and transform your audience. This is Scotty out.